On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 1998, when the USA finished dead last in the World Cup, soccer fans wondered whether the land of grand passions for baseball, basketball, and Super Bowl football would ever make its mark on the world's game. American women had taken it all in soccer, but men, not close. Then in 2002, the U.S. team upset Portugal and drove to the World Cup quarterfinals and nearly beyond, leaving plenty of disdainful Europeans with a scare to remember. Now it's World Cup fever time again, this year in Germany, and a generation of Americans who grew up on soccer is taking the field. Up next on Point, World Cup fever and the American way of soccer. Joining me now from Hamburg, Germany, is Grant Wall, senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He's been covering the U.S. soccer team since the dark ages of 1996 and is fresh back from their only open practice session this week. Grant Wall, thanks very much for being with us. Describe the gathering storm for us there in Germany. What's the schedule?
Well, the anticipation is so high at this point. People have been waiting for this tournament to start for years, literally, and ever since the draw took place last December and everyone realized who was going to play each other, that only ratcheted the excitement level up even further. So the games start on Friday. The host, Germany, plays Costa Rica, and you flip on the TV here. It's only my first day here, and all you see is stuff about the World Cup.
And the U.S. team in their opening frame of teams that they're up against is a very, very tough crowd, the death crowd, we read.
Well, I mean, some people are calling it a group of death, which is the name that's given to the toughest of the eight groups in this World Cup. I would say it's the second toughest of the eight groups overall. Each group has four teams. The U.S. drew Italy, a three-time world champion, the Czech Republic, which is the number two ranked team in the world, and Ghana, which is one of the top teams in Africa. So it's really got its work cut out for them.
Remind us of the U.S. men's team's recent history with the World Cup, 98, 2002, the ramp to this year.
Well, 98 was a complete disaster. The U.S. finished dead last out of the 32 teams at that World Cup, lost all three games, only scored one goal, and it really set the game back quite a bit in the U.S. And then 4 years ago, under a new coach, Bruce Arena, the U.S. went all the way to the quarterfinals, which is a tremendous accomplishment in a sport that every country in the world is trying to win. And that really changed the way a lot of people around Europe, around the rest of the world, look at U.S. soccer.
Now the U.S. team is formally ranked number five, fifth. So does that mean it's in quarterfinal contention at the very least this year, or what?
Well, the ranking system is a little screwed up. I think even most of the American players would admit they're not the fifth best team in the world. But I think that most people do look at the U.S. as a top 10, top 15 team that could threaten to go to the quarterfinals once again here. It's a really tough tournament, though, and a lot is dependent on the draw, and it's going to be awfully tough.
Who's sort of leading in the odds-on favorites for the top of the heap this year?
Well, Brazil, every year, it seems like, and this time is no different. You've got some people even on the Brazilian team saying this could be the best Brazil team ever, which would be the best team ever. And so in a sense, they're competing not just against the 31 other teams here, but against history. They're that good. They got an amazing offense on the field led by a really special player named Ronaldinho.
Everybody's talking about Ronaldinho. You've got some links to clips of his amazing tricks, the beautiful game, at our website, onpointradio.org. There's something else. What about among European teams who look strong there?
Well, the host team, Germany, the host is always a threat to go very deep in the tournament. South Korea went all the way to the semifinals last time, which is a lot farther than anyone expected. The Germans may not be quite as good as some of their best teams of all time. They're young, but they have a ton of support here and could make a run. You look at a team like the Italians, is another team that could do quite well. And a lot of the usual suspects, the Netherlands, France, Spain, and England is a team that thinks they can win their first or their second world championship and their first since 1966.
Sounds pretty wide open. What about from Africa, Asia? Who's strong?
Well, Africa's got an interesting situation this year. There's five teams from Africa. four of them are in this for the first time. Traditional powers like Nigeria and Cameroon didn't even qualify for the tournament. And so you have a team like Ivory Coast is a team that is in its first tournament, but people think it might do quite well here. Ghana is another team, the one that the U.S. will play in its first round group that could do well. And then from Asia, you look at a team like South Korea, which made the semifinals last time, and Japan has been a lot of World Cups and has a lot of experience and could do well here.
And take us out to that American team. You've seen them in the only open practice session they're going to have there. Who's looking hot? Who's big on the American squad?
Well, at this point, Landon Donovan is the man that's going to have to produce for the U.S. He's the 24-year-old offensive star of this team. He had a good World Cup 4 years ago as a 20-year-old in South Korea. And yet, since then, he's done quite well in the domestic league, Major League Soccer, but he has not done well in his short stints in the German league. And in a sense, he's having to reprove himself on the international stage again here at the World Cup. He may not agree with that, but he wants to do very well here, especially in Germany, where things haven't gone very well for him in the past.
Grant Wall in Hamburg, please stand by. It's great to have you there. Grant Wall, senior writer for Sports Illustrated magazine. We've got some great voices we're going to be speaking with this hour about soccer on the world stage and soccer in the USA. Joining me right now in the studio, one of those great voices, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR sports program Only a Game, a diehard soccer fan. Bill Littlefield, great to have you with us.
I'm very delighted to be here and thrilled that I will be in the presence of such experts. I plan to learn a great deal over the next 45 minutes or so.
Bill, you have spent, is it fair to say, years a soccer field side in the USA. Paint a picture for us of how this great big USA fits into the world soccer picture. Now, we were kind of, you know, we stood at the sidelines for a long, 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 long time. Now we've got kids who grew up with it. Are we there yet?
I think it's a very difficult thing to paint a picture, as you have suggested, mm-hmm. because there is such a tremendous range among the people here in terms of how much attention they pay and how much enthusiasm they bring to this event, which, of course, as you've suggested, Tom, generates such incredible enthusiasm all around
the rest of
the world. I would like to go to a cafe in Jamaica Plain when Trinidad Tobago plays. The place will be packed with people living here who used to be in Trinidad and Tobago.
Hear the cheers go up.
Watch, absolutely. I want to go to a pub here where expats from England will gather to watch that game. But I think that the answer to your question is that there is more enthusiasm here in the U.S. I think people have begun to identify some of the stars who've come up through systems. I want to hear Grant talk a little bit about not only Landon Donovan, mm-hmm. but the three other fellows who were all gathered together mm-hmm. in a camp when they were teenagers or just older than teenagers and who have come along together and really give this this team its personality.
We'll look at exactly that because, of course, there was a big decision made after the 98 fiasco. But I guess here's my beginning question, Bill. With all those mother and father hours spent at the soccer field site and the kids pouring their hearts into soccer in the United States for years now, is that adding up to a kind of continuum that reaches right into a World Cup stadium, or are we still playing off in some lesser cosmos?
I think it has added up to something rather significant. Not only is it significant that Major League Soccer still exists,
right,
that there are
right.
more soccer-specific stadiums than ever before, that the ownership of the teams in the league has spread out so they're not all owned by the same guy anymore. All of these are important, that more people are paying attention by mm-hmm. whatever measure you use, attendance, TV, whatever. Sponsorship is much greater, mm-hmm. Corporate sponsorship, than it used to be for MLS. And this all translates into people feeling like they have a stake in the game as it's played at the World Cup.
And Grant Wall, remind us about the play itself. You've written how in early 99, after that fiasco in 98, the sort of soccer powers in the United States said, we have to do different. They set up a all-soccer, all-the-time high school in Bradenton, Florida. What has come out of that?
Well, you've got four players on this team, all 24 years old or younger, who could have a tremendous impact on the U.S.'s chances here. All four could start. Landon Donovan, I'd already mentioned. Mm-hmm. Aguchi Onyewu could be the breakout star of this tournament for the U.S., just a hulking defender in the center of the defense.
6'4", 210?
Oh, yeah, 215, maybe even 220.
Okay. That going up, going up.
Recently here. He's just a monster out there. And And then DeMarcus Beasley played in the World Cup 4 years ago on the wing, on the left for the U.S., has a lot of confidence. And Bobby Convey is a year younger than those guys, was the youngest player on that 99 World Championship youth team. And he's maybe in the best form of anybody on this team right now and could perhaps sneak into the starting lineup for the opener on Monday.
Grant, is there an American style of soccer play? If you took the shirts away and didn't know, could you look out at Americans playing and say, yep, that's the U.S. team?
I don't think there's a necessarily a style. Maybe one is developing. There's so many different sources and influences on the way that Americans play soccer. If you ask people here in Europe or in South America how do Americans play, they tend to say they play with a lot of effort and hustle, and they use a lot of terms like that, which is a way of saying we don't think they're very talented. And so maybe that's changing a little bit. Players like Claudio Reyna over the years have come to Europe and have brought skill in addition to athleticism, which is something that the U.S. has always been known for.
We're talking about the World Cup, world soccer, and America's place in that universe. Let's listen back to that 2002 World Cup victory. U.S. pulled it out over Portugal.
Agus driving it toward the arc. It bounces all the way through. Jorge Costa, with Donovan's pressure, gets it away. Sané taking a chance. The ball deflects to Donovan. The deflection scores! Landon Donovan! 2-0! United States!
And if you didn't notice, they were a little excited. The first name you heard there, Agus, U.S. defender Jeff Agus, he'll be joining us in a moment. Right now with us from New York is Ireland's Tommy Smith, ESPN soccer analyst, former voice of Major League Soccer's New York Metro Stars. He calls 150 international games a year. Tommy Smith, it's wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom. Delighted to be with you.
So when you look out on this American team, and America in general, in the soccer universe, what do you see? Are we a player or not?
Yeah, we're becoming a player. The U.S. is certainly becoming a player. I mean, you know, you go around various parks now and you see kids wearing Ronaldinho jerseys. You see them wearing Roy Keane jerseys. 20 years ago, this would never have happened. I mean, unfortunately, for a long time, Americans tended to look inwards rather than looking outwards. But now in sports, they're starting to look outwards and they're starting to realize that there is something besides baseball, football and basketball and hockey.
And when the American team takes the field in Germany, I don't know, put yourself in European team shoes. Do they see a threat? Do they see a country still wet behind the ears in this game?
Yeah, they see a threat. I mean, you know, a lot of people seem to have this attitude that, oh, Americans don't get the respect they deserve around the world. There's only one thing to get your respect in the World Cup, and that is by winning games. It doesn't matter where you come from. You can be Togo, you can be Angola, you can be the U.S., you can be France. If you got to go out and play a team in the World Cup, you are a threat, because we know over the years that everything that happens in the World Cup, the one thing you can be sure of is the unexpected is going to happen. Who would have given, you know, in 1998, who would have given France any shot at winning it, yet now they lift the trophy? Who would have given Turkey any shot at being in the Final Four the last time around, but they were there? So, I mean, every team who plays, every one of the 32 teams who plays is a definite threat in World Cup play.
And is there a national style of play, Tommy Smith, that you can discern in the teams from different countries? Are you able to look out and say, oh yeah, that's an Italian team, that's a German, that's a Brazilian with their beautiful game, that's American?
Without a doubt, without a doubt. There's no question. Each continent, and there are 184 teams who start out in the World Cup qualifiers, and each team brings something a little bit different to the table. Each continent brings something a little different to the table, and there certainly is an American way of playing soccer. The American way of playing soccer compared to a lot of other countries is that they do a lot more running than a lot of other countries. I mean, for many, many years, people laughed at the Irish way of playing soccer. When Jack Charlton was playing, Jack would lash the ball down long and hope that somebody would run onto it. You look at the Brazilians, I mean, it looks like the ball is tied to their foot.
Yes, you know, it does.
They have a little string on the ball,
yeah.
And they just walk up the field with this string hanging out, and the ball just happens to be on the end of it.
Foot magnetism.
So, without a doubt.
Bill Littlefield, how about it? The American coach, Bruce Arena, has been quoted saying, with a little anguish, you know, look, I don't have one unified culture here. I've got the melting pot of America. I don't have generations of kids playing in the same way, so it's all a chemistry in their bones. There's a lot we're pulling together. Is there an American way of play that you can discern, Bill?
Well, I would defer to Tommy on that. If he says there's an American way, then I'm sure there is an American way. He has the advantage of having seen such a great deal of soccer and also seeing it from a bit of an outsider's point of view. But I'm curious whether he or any of these experts that we've been lucky enough to have with us feel that the one element that may have changed the American approach this time around is speed, that this is a faster team. They've counted on running all the time, but are they faster? Are they better at running? Are they more likely to get free up front and be better at scoring goals this time around?
Tommy, Grant, what about the speed issue?
Well, you know, Bob Hayes was a great sprinter, but that didn't mean he was any good when he got the ball at his feet. So I don't think that the speed necessarily comes into play like that. One of the problems that the U.S. have had so far in qualifying and also in, on the friendlies coming up has been the lack of finishing. I mean, when you get past Brian McBride, they don't have anybody who, as Ike would say, would bulge the old onion bag. I mean, and that's one of the things. It doesn't matter how open you are. You one-on-one with the keeper. If you don't put the ball in the back of the net, it doesn't matter how you got there or how quickly you got there. It's what you do when you get there. Tommy Doherty used to say, football is not about the possession of the ball. Football is about what you do when you get possession of the ball.
And Grant Wall, what about the size issue? You mentioned Onyewu, he's big, 6'4", 210 or maybe more, but he's not the only one. You've got Jan Koller, Czech Republic, U.S. will be playing, he's 6'8". Italy's got 6'4", Luca Toni. What about the size of these American players?
Well, athleticism and physicality is a tremendous part of this World Cup, more and more so every 4 years. You look at a player that the U.S. may start up front as a striker, and that's Eddie Johnson, a kid who is tall, but who also can run like the wind. And I think that's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure on Bruce Arena to decide, do I want to start Eddie Johnson, a guy who brings those physical skills up front but hasn't necessarily done a very good job of finishing over the last several months? That's going to be a decision I think a lot of people are looking for from Arena for this opening game against the Czech Republic. Does he start Johnson up front, or does he start Landon Donovan up front, who doesn't bring the skills in the air that Johnson does, but does have the speed and the experience?
Tommy Smith, what about it? The U.S. team headed into the so-called group of death, Italy, Czech Republic, Ghana, very tough to get through there. What's your advice to Bruce Arena? Be so bold.
Okay, first of all, I don't buy this that the U.S. are in the group of death. U.S. are in the near group of death, I like to call it. The group of death is actually, in my opinion, it's Argentina, Netherlands, Serbia, and Montenegro, and the Ivory Coast. That, to me, is the group of death. Bruce Arena's problem is that he has to get a result out of the Czech Republic, because everybody knows that the Italians start out very slow, but the U.S. are playing the Italians in the second game. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. played the Italians in the first game. It might have been like the game against Portugal the last time around. He has to get something out of the Czech Republic. The Czech Republic have very, very skillful players. Jan Koller, I mean, we're talking about the U.S. defender being big, but he hasn't really done anything. He's played in Belgium. Jan Koller has played with the best in the world and beaten the best in the world.
At 6'8" tall, he's huge.
And not alone that, but he's very smart, he's very tricky, and he knows how to play this game. My mom used to say, big trees are easily climbed when you knock them, and that's going to be the problem that defenders are going to have. Jan Koller is going to knock them, because Jan Koller will walk right into you, and he will bowl you over and keep going with the ball. So that's one thing that Bruce Arena is going to have to be very careful of. He has to find somebody who can play alongside Brian McBride. He needs to find somebody who can score goals. I mean, everybody had hyped this Eddie Johnson as being the next coming of Maradona when he started scoring goals.
Yeah.
He hasn't lived up to that. He hasn't followed through. And that's what this game is all about. When you get to the big stage, that you have to be able to perform. It may be a case that he has to put Landon Donovan up front alongside of McBride, but then he loses Landon Donovan in midfield. He has to hope that John O'Brien is as fit as he should be, and that Claudio Reyna is as fit as he should be. To me, the key to the U.S. midfield would be John O'Brien and Claudio Reyna playing two fit players.
Well, we're feeling the electricity now, Tommy Smith. We appreciate your bringing it on. ESPN soccer analyst Tommy Smith, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom. Take care of yourself and enjoy the World Cup. Believe me, it's something very, very special. Only comes once every 4 years. It's kind of like Ireland. There's 32 teams and there's 32 counties in Ireland. That's why we love it so much. We're not there. We'll be enjoying it.
We will love it up one side and down the other. Bill Littlefield, Grant Wall, stand by. Ron's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Well, hi, Tom. I have a wonderful story that relates back to an earlier question you asked about soccer growth from the youth on.
Yeah.
Here I am sitting about ready to celebrate my 60th birthday, and I got a call from my son about a month ago. He said, Dad, you remember how you took me to see the NASL Tampa Bay Rowdies play in their Super Bowl many years ago against the Cosmos? And I said, yeah. He said, well, sit down. I'm bringing you to the World Cup. He started playing when he was 5 years old. He is now 35.
Yeah.
Calling up, he played his entire high school career and college career in Central Florida, very competitive. Here he is now, successful, and he's reciprocated, bringing Dad to the World Cup.
How fantastic. When do you fly, Ron, and what games are you going to – what are you going to see?
We fly out Saturday a week on the 16th of June. We're seeing Switzerland and Togo. He said, Dad, I can't manage to take the time to get to U.S. And we said, we don't care. We're flying into Dusseldorf. We are going to be part of all the excitement to see two teams that we don't know much about. But this is a perfect example because where he started to play at 5 years old, 3 years ago, he has two sons, my grandsons, and they're already picking the game up.
There it is, already getting into the blood, and Dad's got some payback here. We hope you have a great, great time there, Ron, and thank you so much for calling in from Columbia. Let me get a call from Catherine in Roxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling just to say that, you know, I grew up in northern New Jersey. I started playing soccer when I was 7, I think. We had a really competitive program in our town, and
I went
to the 94 World Cup, one of the games in New Jersey. We could only get a ticket for one person, so I went by myself, and I sat between an older Italian guy and an older Norwegian guy, but I went. And now I'm married to a Cameroonian national. We have two little ones, a one-year-old who doesn't even walk yet, but every time a ball comes near him, he tries to give it a kick.
The instinct is working. The mojo's there.
Yeah, and our four-year-old is already a whiz. He's actually playing with the team in JP and with the kids team. And he sees – I bought a poster at the 94 game, and every time he sees it, he says that that's him.
So are you going to be watching, Catherine? Will your eyes be glued to the World Cup?
We're going to try and catch as many games as we can. I think my husband will be probably rooting for Ivory Coast, given that Cameroon isn't in this year.
Right.
And I would like to see TNT go far just because, you know, a little team.
Trinidad and Tobago, you'll be rooting there. We've got a whole global rooting session right here, Catherine. It's wonderful to have you with us. Thanks for calling. I want to turn right now to Munich, Germany, and we're delighted to have with us Jeff Agus, former star defender for the U.S. national team. You heard it in the clip we played just before in South Korea, member of the 98 and 2002 U.S. World Cup teams. He's now a color commentator for World Cup on XM Satellite Radio, nicknamed the Goose. Jeff Agus, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks so much,
Tom,
for joining us.
Appreciate the opportunity.
You're here with Grant Wall and Bill Littlefield. Everybody's delighted to have you. What do you make of the U.S. team this year, Jeff?
Well, I think it's the deepest U.S. team that we've ever had. The only problem is we're in probably the toughest group that we've ever faced. We've got, you know, the Czechs up first, then the Italians and the Ghanaian team, who no one knows anything about, and they could be a big surprise. So it's a tough group to have to go through.
Jeff, is the U.S. getting over the hump? Those many decades when this was not a big sport here, now for at least a couple, it's been growing like Topsy. Is that showing up in the U.S. team's play?
I think if you look at the progress we've made from 1990 to 2006, it's been incredible. The development of our sport, both you know, in the media and on the field, has been incredible. We've come a long way. So we still have a ways to go on the MLS side and getting that league going, and I think it's going in the right direction. But our national team is really taking off because of the MLS.
Is the men's American team ever going to win until, you know, American kids age 4 and 5 and 2 and 3, like Catherine who called in, have a soccer ball at the end of their foot, you know, from the moment they can walk? Is that what it takes?
Yeah, I think we need this sport to be part of the culture and fabric of America. I don't think it's there yet. It can be there. It's not as popular a spectator sport as, say, football, baseball, basketball, you know, the big four or five sports, but it can be. It's a great game to watch. It's a great game to play, and And the thing about soccer is anybody can play it. You don't have to be 6 foot 5 inches tall to play the game.
Bill Littlefield, what's it take to finally break it through into that sort of sacred inner circle of American sports? Or does that just not happen? Once a country's settled on its three or four, you know, major sports, that's it. Everybody else is a permanent outsider.
Well, there are so many theories about this that I don't know which one to come down on. A guess that you're going to have a little later in the program will tell you that there is no room once a country has selected the sports upon which it will concentrate, the two or three or four. It's awfully hard for one more to squeeze its way
English
in.
The official language, and baseball, basketball, football, the trifecta.
I don't think I buy it. This is a big country, and it's a country with so many diverse currents coming in, and people coming in from all over the place and bringing all sorts of different kinds of energies. And I see an awful lot of people paying an awful lot of attention to soccer, and even if it doesn't show up quite as dramatically in the numbers as it does with some of the other sports. And of course, the owners haven't locked the players out yet either, which is kind of nice.
It's got
that going
for it.
Kind of nice to have a sport where that hasn't happened at this point. But it's very hard to predict. But I think Jeff's point is excellent, and that is that we have a terrific national team, and the success of that team certainly 4 years ago in the World Cup got a lot of people more excited about MLS. Mm-hmm. About half the players on this national team play their club soccer here in the U.S. for MLS teams. There's every reason to think that it will continue to flourish.
Grant Wall, when you see the American players, you know, they don't have the same kind of mad support at home as so many of the World Cup teams have. They run into a little bit of anti-American sentiment abroad. Does that affect the play?
Well, I think it's always tough to play in a situation when you have everyone against you. It's tough, I'm sure, to play, as Jeff could tell you, in Los Angeles when if you're playing against Mexico and you have 90,000 fans cheering against you in your own country. But it's amazing to me, and I think that the U.S. players over the years, and especially today, deserve so much credit for how much they've improved, despite the fact that there's not tremendous, overwhelming national support for this team like there is in other countries. And it's something that they've gotten past it, and now they see that there is more support building in the United States for the American team, that they can play in Columbus, Ohio, in a huge qualifier for the World Cup against Mexico, win the game, and have a crowd that's completely in the U.S.'s favor.
Grant Wall with Sports Illustrated, senior writer there in Hamburg now for the World Cup. Grant, it's been great having you. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Julio's calling from New Milford, Connecticut. Hi, Julio. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, what are you going to do? Are you going to be there?
No, I wish I was able to. I am a teacher and have the time off, and I would be able to go. But that means that I've cleared my calendar for watching as many games as possible during the day, and try to start brainwashing my kids also into the event that it is.
That it has to be seen in all its splendor. Who are you rooting for, Julio?
Well, USA is my first team, and second favorite would be Spain. Just because I spent a lot of time there, although I don't know that Spain can actually do it. They've, underachievers, so to speak.
But clearing the calendar in New Milford, Connecticut, we hear it. That's great. Good luck. Enjoy it. From Atlanta, Georgia, John is calling. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. John down here. I got to say, boy, all this enthusiasm was amazing. I just got back from spending a week in Germany working, and all over Frankfurt and the area that I was in, there's World Cup stuff happening everywhere. But I have to say that playing soccer is a lot of fun. Watching it is like watching paint dry, and listening to it on the radio is like the Chinese water torture. It's awful.
Until they start screaming goal. You get us right to the nub of it. This is where it comes down for Americans, I think, in the ambivalence, John. So do you watch or not, or you just want to get the ball and play?
It's torture. I mean, watching it is just boring, and listening to it is worse. Playing's a lot of fun. But,
okay.
Playing baseball is a lot of fun, but watching it's awful too. So.
So it's not alone there, but you get us right down to it, John, and we appreciate your call. To respond to that, I want to turn to Vienna, Austria. Why not? Great pastries. Andrei Markovitz is there. He's a professor of comparative politics and German studies at the University of Michigan, author of Offside, Soccer, and American Exceptionalism. He studies comparative sociology of modern sports. Andrei Markovitz, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So here you are. Jeff Agus is with us, Bill Littlefield of Only a Game, and you've got the theory that there's only room for so many sports in the heart of a nation is soccer making it into the American heart.
Well, the last caller just said it all. There's a complete difference between playing something and following something. Following something is very few sports are followed by a multitude of people. And this is what I call hegemonic sports. And they basically developed between 1860 and 1920. And it so happens that in the United States, we don't have one, we don't have two, we actually have three or even three and a half, if one calls hockey that, and one should, but it's, of course, spotty. And in much of Europe, or virtually all of Europe and all of Latin America, though not every part of the world, this hegemonic sports culture is soccer. And people grow up following it, and I think your caller said it totally, the last one. That he thinks playing it is like, playing he loves it, and following it is like watching paint dry over. I mean, of course, this is for someone who knows the game and knows the language. This, of course, sounds terrible, but understandable, because these sports are like very complex languages, and the earlier you learn them, the better you speak it. And this is, and it's not only the speaking itself, but everything that it entails, the meta language, the smells, the connections, the history. Every time I watch a soccer game or a baseball game or go to an opera, I don't only watch that event, I discourse with it in terms of the past. I go to a soccer game and immediately think of how this reminds me of a game in Romania, and another game, how this guy in the inside right reminds me of so-and-so. Actually, Jeff Agus was one of my favorite defenders, and it reminded me actually of a particular player that I watched when I spent time in Vienna, who played for Austria Wien. This you cannot learn by playing only.
So the whole story running through the minds of that kind of fan. Jeff Agus, let me ask you about that. I mean, you know the meta language, the history, the smells, and all of it, as Andrew Markowitz describes. When you sit with fans watching soccer in Latin America or Europe, and you feel how they're responding to what they see, is it viscerally different than an American crowd's reaction?
It absolutely is, and I'll say this: I think what the caller is getting to is that it's passion. It's what drives these people. These teams represent their cities or their countries, and they get behind these teams with everything they've got. It means a lot to them. I don't think we've gotten there yet in the United States, because the teams, you know, we have a league that's only 10 years old now. We're competing against other leagues that are 80, 90, 100 years old, and we haven't stitched ourselves into the fabric of the American culture. I think Americans will get behind a winner no matter what it is. I mean, if there's a ping pong player who is the best ping pong player in the world, I think you'll see him on ESPN every other week. And if we can do that with soccer, I think the sport would get a lot more exposure and a lot more media attention, and could be woven into that fabric.
We certainly know what sports passion feels like. I mean, Americans have it for many sports. My gosh, in Boston with the Red Sox, it's breathing.
Exactly. But the Red Sox are the Red Sox, the Patriots, and of course, when they're good, obviously the Celtics and the Bruins.
And right across the country.
You know, it's basically, think about this, and typically roll all those four passions into one, and you have the passion for a European soccer team, which, by the way, moreover, unlike American teams, European teams often represent a certain class or represent a certain religion or represent a certain kind of political direction.
They do?
In the city I am right now in Vienna, there used to be red clubs.
Oh, I see, right.
Black clubs, Catholic clubs, and socialist clubs.
Mm-hmm.
So the passion is not only about the game of soccer, it's about a certain, an entire political viewpoint, an entire way of life.
I think it begs the question, why is there passion in Europe or Latin America for soccer, and it's not there in the United States?
Because
it just seems like the U.S. attention span is not the same as it is in Europe, because in America we're used to the sport stopping and starting,
right.
Whereas in the game of soccer, you go 45 minutes at a time before you pause.
I hear Andre in Vienna disagreeing there.
Massively.
Why? Why?
Massively, because believe me, you know, baseball games are long. If you are an advanced speaker of these languages, you in fact love defense and you love pitchers' duels.
Of the sports language, as it were.
Yeah, I mean, but it's not only just to knowing the rules. So, for instance, I actually really resist this notion that Americans are somehow antsy or less patient.
Mm.
They just don't know the language, and it takes a long time.
Mm.
to become, to have the iconic dimension.
We see it. But Littlefield, do you feel that language seeping in to the American mind?
I think it's more than seeping in. I mean, what happens when a great team comes over here to play, whether it's FC Barcelona Juventus or whatever? All of a sudden, no matter where they play, stadiums
pouring
fill.
Out. Mm.
And they're not filled exclusively with Spaniards or Italians on vacation in Boston, coming to Gillette to see these teams play. People do understand that there is something here that's worth seeing. And I think that the composition of the population of this country is so varied that numbers of people have, in fact, grown up knowing the language of soccer.
Right.
Not perhaps the average suburban soccer mom and soccer dad who sees it as a sport the junior plays until it's time for him to move along and put away his childish things and go to law school.
Right.
But lots of other components of this culture, which is so varied and which is, of course, I think, its strength.
And there it comes. Let me take a call from Amarillo, Texas. Richard is on the line. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Greetings.
Greetings.
Great conversation. I thought that the women's team helped the American culture learn a whole lot about that language. You guys haven't mentioned it once. I'm really surprised about that.
I'm ashamed not to have mentioned it.
As a matter of fact, we said it right at the top of the hour that the women have done it, and they've done it twice, and it's an astounding feat. Why do you think it hasn't come over to men?
But can I say something about that?
Sure.
About the women? That, again, is a form of American exception. In no other country are the women as important. In fact, I was just on an Austrian radio show where that was seen as yet another form of American abomination. Basically seeing yet another form of America soiling.
What, that we put too much emphasis on our women's soccer?
No. The point is this. It's very simple. The women, by dint of Title IX, the whole side of women as sports producers, meaning as players, changed completely. One in two women are engaged in some form of sport today. It used to be 1 in 30.
But we've cheered for that in this country. What's the problem?
You cheered for one particular event. We cheered because it was a national thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big event. But would we cheer for when the New York team played the Philly team? And that's how you create culture. And that's why now, coming back to Bill's point about when Juventus comes and Barca comes, of course these are big events. People love to go to that because people know about their jerseys and they know that's important, but that's not how you measure this. You measure this by week in and week out, by people waking up in the morning and looking at the box scores and thinking about why the idiot coach is doing this instead of doing that.
Right, down in all the details. Richard and Amarillo, we've got it in your mind. Is Jeff Agus, let me put that to you first, about the women's team. Was that on your mind, on the men's team, as you step into the World Cup? The U.S. women have already done this. Come on, guys. How did you look out on that accomplishment?
Well, I think it was phenomenal for the women's side to do as well as they have, and really, the women's team has been a dominant force in soccer. But if you look at the overall scheme of things, there's really only about six or seven teams that are strong in the world, and now there's more catching up to China, Norway, and Germany. More of those teams are now catching the United States. Whereas with the men, literally any given day, one of 20 nations can win these games, win a World Cup. So I think there's more parity on the men's side right now than there is on the women's side.
And what about this issue of having it sort of in the blood, deep in the culture, for the men's team, until Americans are like going gaga over soccer, and you can feel that in the stadium, can the U.S. win the World Cup, Jeff? Or do you feel a kind of a shortfall, a deficit when you're playing?
I think it's a very difficult task to win the World Cup, but I think any team is capable. Any team that makes it to the World Cup is certainly capable of winning a World Cup. Obviously, you got to look at the Germanys and Brazils, Argentinas, who have got the experience and who've got the big name players to be favorites. But these are this is basically the ultimate March Madness every 4 years, and you never know what's going to happen.
Patrick's calling from Marblehead, Massachusetts. Patrick, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Hi, Bill.
Hey.
You and I have met on occasion. I'm the other half of Seamus.
Oh, well, excellent. Then you're the other half of something quite fine indeed, and I have all the respect in the world for you.
My observations, I've been playing this game in this country for 40-plus years, a lot of the parents do a lot of the coaching, and my observation to your person I talked to was when the game was over, parents went home and watched baseball. They don't watch the Premier League.
So coach at the soccer field, go home and watch baseball or football or whatever.
That's what the kids see.
Yeah.
It doesn't continue from the field. It's a great activity for the children.
Right.
Because I believe in it. But once they go home, they watch the NFL.
So the culture sweeps back in, and we hear it. Patrick, thanks for calling. Let me turn to Finbar in Columbia, South Carolina. Finbar, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I'd like to address the question.
Well, the Irish are out today. Yes, sir.
Yeah, there you go. Tommy Smith. Yeah, and I played schoolboy international for Ireland as a 15-year-old. But anyway, I just want to address the idea of the difficulty of scoring a goal. And this is one of the problems that Americans have with soccer. It's not high scoring, whereas, you know, in basketball, it's relatively easy to get a basket, but people don't appreciate the effort that goes into scoring a goal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, the scoring is not quite as high as people get bored with that. But to make a comparison with that, for example, in O levels in the British educational system, an A at O levels, which corresponds to about, the AP here in the United States.
Yeah.
An A grade is 65% and above. And you can see the analogy I'm making, that it's the test is so difficult that if you can achieve 65% and above, you've done something wonderful.
So is this a dig at American culture, Finbar, that we don't know what real difficulty is? And if we did, we'd be soccer maniacs.
Well, last Saturday on Wait, Don't Tell Me, you had the guy, the British commentator guy, saying that we were a bunch of ADHD addicts over here. And that's why, it was very funny. But I think that's, the appreciation of just how difficult it is.
It's a very good
bulge
point.
The bulge in the old onion bag, as Tommy said.
Right, the bulge in the onion bag. Finbar, thanks for joining us. Our time goes short. Andrew Markovitz, what about it? Is there fundamental? Are Americans a culture that wants to see the ball going through the hoop?
No.
Every 16 seconds.
No. Because it so happens our games that we were creating, that the big three, happen to have been higher scoring, and offense is easier understood than defense. But there's nothing essentialist about this. There's nothing about Americans who inherently can't learn or appreciate. It's a long process. It is far from guaranteed. I would turn it exactly around from someone who said it. It seems to me that we could win the World Cup with the men, not this time, maybe not next time. Some point we will. But that still is not a guarantee that soccer will become daily culture. It might not. Following and playing are two different things. And there's no guarantee that it will ever become that. And maybe it shouldn't. I mean, there's no reason other than for my sake, and all of us who are talking here would love to see it become, for the New England Revolution to be the next Red Sox. I would love that to happen in my lifetime. There's no guarantee that it will.
Jeff Agus, are we going to be able to win if we're still doing soccer with our left hand and that kind of conception?
Well, Americans always will try to find a way to win games, and I think that's the attitude that Americans have going into these games. I think it's important to be successful in major tournaments. I think that's what's going to help the visibility of this sport. This sport is the World Cup comes around only every 4 years, and it seems it's a little bit like the Olympics, where you only get this type of visibility every 4 years. And I agree with the caller. I'd love to see this visibility on a day-to-day, week-to-week, and year-to-year basis.
Well, you helped make it happen in 2002, Jeff Agus, with XM Satellite Radio. Thanks so much for joining us from Munich.
Thank you.
Andy Markovitz in Vienna, Austria. Enjoy it there. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Bill Littlefield, host of the wonderful NPR's Only a Game. Bill, wonderful to have you this hour.
Thank you, Tom. I learned a lot.
We'll go out with some sound from that great 2002 U.S. upset in Korea.
Showing to the ball. Mastrowani. Donovan brings it down nicely. Saleh on the overlap. The defender is Jorge Costa. McBride's in the box. A hard cross. McBride scores! It's 3-0 United States! They're bombing Portugal!
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.